Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the Premier Networks on Sunday, February 3rd, 2019. This is episode 1563. A little program note. We are doing, as we do every year, our annual survey, audience survey, and we'd love it if you would weigh in with information about who you are, why you listen, how you listen. It helps us tailor our programming to fit your needs. It also helps us, I'll be frank, sell to advertisers because, frankly, we don't collect information about you any other way. And so advertisers are always saying, well, how many men are listening? How many women? Where are they? What are their ages? That kind of thing. So it really does help us a little bit with tailoring ads for the advertisers. And frankly, that's what keeps us on the air. I'll be honest with you. But I do also say that we don't collect information about you in any other way. And in this survey, we won't ask for your email address. We won't take any personal information. We just use it in aggregate. It does help us a lot. So if you would do me a favor and go to twit.to/survey19. twit.to/survey19 and take the survey. It really makes a big difference. It helps us both give you the programming you want and help advertisers find the right show for them. Thank you. twit.to/survey19. The TWiT podcast is brought to you by DigitalOcean, the simplest cloud platform for developers and teams. Deploy, manage, and scale cloud applications faster and more efficiently with DigitalOcean. Sign up today and receive a free $100 credit at do.co/TWiT. And by Carbonite, the premier data protection platform for business with customizable cloud and hybrid backup for your servers. To learn more, visit Carbonite.com. And by WordPress. Turn your dreams into reality and launch your website at WordPress.com. Get 15% off any new plan at WordPress.com/tech guy. Oh, I get so excited when I hear that music. You get excited when you hear that music? No, probably not, but I do. It's time for the Tech Guy. Oh, my favorite show. It is, honest. It's time to talk tech with me, Leo Laporte. I am the Tech Guy. Well, let's be honest. I am a tech guy. I'm the guy with the microphone. But you know what? This is a show where it's all of us together. A user group of the airwaves at 8888 Ask Leo. If you've got a question, a thought, a comment, if you've got a recommendation, if you want to talk high tech, this is the place, a safe space for all us geeks and wannabe geeks and people who say, and it happens all the time, I'm not a geek. But I've got a hard drive that is probably the MFM sectors, and I'd like to... I'm not a geek. I'm a geek. But I'll try to speak non-geek speak today. English, please. 8888-ASK-LEO. 888-827-5536. That's toll-free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. If you're outside that area, you could still call. It's even toll-free, but you have to use something like Skype Out that can ring a phone using voice of the internet. As long as you're calling that 8888 Ask Leo number, it shouldn't cost you anything. Not a thing. Here's a scary one. BuzzFeed News. One of the biggest at-home DNA testing companies is working with the FBI. Ooh. It's a company called Family Tree DNA. I'm not familiar with that. I should mention one of our sponsors, 23andMe, does the same thing, but they do, as far as I know, they don't share their information with the feds. Have you done family? This is one of those. They're all the same. This is a kind of similar idea. You spit into a tube and they go back and the way these companies do their DNA testing is kind of interesting. They compare your tests to a panel of known genetics. And then if there's a similarity to somebody who's got Alzheimer's or cancer, then they say, oh, yeah, you might have this tendency, that kind of thing. So that's I think they're fun. I did 23andMe a long time ago. I've done several of them. I did a long time ago. But there's always been the concern, and I know a lot of you have this concern about privacy. And I think you, if you do one of these tests, you probably should read the privacy statement before you give them your DNA. I mean, after all, you can't change your DNA. You can't, if it leaks out somehow, and you can't say, oh, well, I'm going to get a new DNA number. No, it's you. It's you. So there are public genealogy databases, forums, where people go and they submit their DNA looking for relatives, that kind of thing. And in fact, you may remember the story about the Golden State Killer. Remember this one? Long cold case. They never caught the guy. But some of his, they had the DNA from the crime scene, and some of his relatives submitted their DNA to one of these public, you know, forums. Police said, whoa, wait a minute, this matches. He must be the criminal must be a relative of these people, and they were able to actually solve it using family tree DNA. This is the first time a private firm has voluntarily allowed law enforcement access to its database. So now the company, which says we're a pioneer in genetic testing, we were the first to offer the consumer, direct consumer DNA tests, has said, they told BuzzFeed News on Thursday, that allowing access would help law enforcement agencies solve violent crimes faster than ever. Well, that's true. I'm all for that. Family Tree does not have a contract with the DNA, but they've agreed to test DNA samples and upload the profiles to its database on a case-by-case basis since last fall. This started with that one case, the Golden State Killer, last year, and it has expanded. To date, Family Tree DNA says it's cooperated with the FBI in no fewer than 10 cases. Now, the Family Tree database is free to access. Anyone can upload their DNA profile. So you could do it with another company, upload it there. In a way, you're saying, hey, look, anybody can look at this. I'm going to post it here because I want to find relatives. What do you think? Until now, investigators had limited their searches to these kinds of public databases where the information was willingly uploaded. But this is the first time the FBI has gained access to more than 1 million DNA profiles, which were uploaded before the customers had any knowledge of the relationship with the FBI. In other words, customers who went to Family Tree DNA and presumed that their data was private now find out it's been given to the FBI. This is one of those where people say all the time, you hear this, well, if you haven't done anything wrong, you have nothing to fear. Yeah. Yeah. At the same time, it's a slippery slope, isn't it? I mention this because if you use Family Tree, you can opt out of this, of what they call familial matching. Of course, that's the reason you did it, isn't it? But you could opt out of it, and the Family Tree says that would prevent your profile from being searchable by the FBI. But we also won't be able to find any relatives through this, which is Family Tree. That's the name. You won't be the reason you're doing it. What do you think? On the one hand, this is a great tool for law enforcement, isn't it? And after all, I don't think there's an issue, as there is with other things, of false positives. You know, for instance, face recognition. Amazon is selling their face recognition, it's recognition with a K, to law enforcement, knowing that there is a large percentage of false positives, particularly with people who aren't white Caucasians, because the database is built with mostly white folk, and so it does a terrible job with people of color. Now, that to me is concerning when law enforcement is using face recognition technology that has a high percentage of mistakes, particularly with people of color. That is not what you want. But isn't DNA more accurate? I don't know. So, but this is one of those, and we're going to see a lot more. This is the nature of technology. One of those cases where technology has outpaced our legal system, our knowledge, our sense of privacy. What is okay in a situation like this? You want to catch crooks. DNA does not have the same false positive problem that face recognition does. Pretty much if it's a match, it's a match. Solve a lot of cold cases. Presumably, I would hope the FBI is not using your DNA for anything else, but what else could they use it for? They're not giving it to insurance companies. See, that would be bad. That would be bad. If you were denied insurance because your DNA said you had a risk of Alzheimer's or breast cancer, that would be bad, right? We agree. Do we agree on that? I don't know. If you're an insurance company, you might say, well, oh, that's good. That lowers the cost for everybody because we don't have to worry about insuring people who might get sick. 8888-ASK-LEO. It's a fascinating subject. We'll talk more about that in just a little bit. Before we get back to the phones, though, or get to the phones for this Super Bowl Sunday. You know, geeks really don't care about that thing. They call it sport ball or hand egg. They don't they don't care about that kind of thing. But if you do, that's okay. I'll be recording it. We dial the phone, don't we? We tape shows. Neither of which happen anymore. I'll be taping it if we're watching later. It's time once again to open the phone lines and say hello to our phone angel.
Good morning. Happy
Kim
Super Bowl Sunday.
Schaffer. Happy Hand Egg Day.
Hand Egg. I've never heard that before.
Geeks are funny. One of the things they all say is, I'm watching the Puppy Bowl. Mm-hmm. I'm not watching the Super Bowl. That's what Scott Wilkinson says.
Well, it's kind of the Battle of the Bay, but I'm going to have to go for our Marin boy, Jared Goff. So,
Battle of the Bay because Tom Brady's from San Mateo.
San Mateo, yeah.
He's a local boy, too.
So
you'd
Goff.
Never know that if you visit Boston.
Yeah.
Who?
Yeah,
Tom
I'm so
Brady.
Sick of them.
he's not from California. He's a local guy.
Yep.
I've seen him eating lobster. it's a national holiday, isn't it?
For the non-geeks.
I tell you, I think one of the reasons to watch it is because I'm always keeping score of which big tech companies advertise on the Super Bowl. Because, it's expensive. Although you can't assume that somebody who's buying a Super Bowl ad, and they're very expensive, is doing it because they're so successful. Right? They're doing it because it's bragging rights.
Yep.
And man, there's nothing more.
We have enough money to buy a 30-second ad.
Nothing more in the Silicon Valley and more important than bragging rights.
Yep.
The cost of a 30-second ad in the Super Bowl this year is $5.25 million for 30 seconds. So when you watch that Super Bowl ad for GoDaddy or whatever, mm-hmm. You know what I think?
What do you think?
That would have bought a lot of ads on the tech guy.
We could have
advertised for you all year long.
You could have named this the GoDaddy Studio.
I would have called it I don't even like GoDaddy. I would have called it the GoDaddy, live from the GoDaddy Studio.
Yep.
$5.25 million, heck. I'd wear GoDaddy underwear.
You'd get a GoDaddy tattoo.
I'd get a tattoo on my forehead. I would call myself the GoDaddy tech guy. But no, they're going to spend it for 30 lousy seconds.
30 seconds.
On a game where everybody's going off to eat food while their ad's on. Because it's bragging rights.
Yep.
So I have not. Did you watch? Because people do this now. They watch the ads on YouTube and stuff ahead of time.
I'm
in a blackout period right now.
I want to see them for the first time.
Yeah. But I am TiVoing it because.
Because you're going to be here for
A
while.
But also because sometimes you want to rewind and see it again and again.
Yeah, and I always end up being where there's too many people, so I usually miss them all anyway.
You know what Twisted Mister's saying in the chat room? He's saying, oh, that's good. Every time I hit the skip button, I'm going to think, $5.25 million, $5.25 million. $5.25 million. It's gone up quite a bit.
Yep. I wonder how much it was on the Super Bowl number one.
It was pretty cheap. No, in fact, they erased the tape. They didn't think anybody, it was a big deal. No, you can't find it. So in 2002, which is the oldest Super Bowl I have stats for, it was half as much, $2.3 million. Less than half as much. And it really didn't start going up till 2012, $3.5 million. Then it started going up pretty fast. It's been $5 million for the last three Super Bowls. It's $5.25 million this time.
Just like Bay Area home prices.
By the way, TiVo, and I love this. Obviously, there's geeks who work at TiVo. Not they have a new button, game skip. It skips the game and goes to the
only
ads.
Only the commercials?
Only the commercials. That's going to save me a lot of time.
That's going to be the way to watch it. I'd love to do that.
Wow. All right. Let's get to the show here, which means let's take some calls.
Steven in Tampa on line two has a question I haven't heard before. And since we're just a couple weeks past CES, I find it to be sort of relevant.
Oh, good. Thank you, Kim Schaffer. Right. Hello, Steven. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Well, thanks for taking my call.
Oh, my pleasure.
Yeah, my question was about CES. I've always wanted to attend CES. I've always liked gadgets and gizmos and technologies, and I know it's not open to the public. So my question is, if I were to start a blog, a tech blog, where I review certain things that I've purchased, you know, like an Apple Watch, Fitbit, GoPros, would that qualify me as media or press in order to register?
That's an interesting question, yeah.
I see all these people on YouTube, and there's, you know...
They've barely seem to have any tech credentials, right? Yeah. How does this guy get in there?
Exactly. So that was my question. If I were to do that, I mean, I'm sure there's a fee for it and all that, but would that qualify me?
Actually, if you're media, there is no fee. So here's the deal.
Oh, okay.
CES, which used to stand for the Consumer Electronics Show and now stands for nothing, is generally attended by dealers, by people in the biz. So the real purpose of CES is for companies who manufacture consumer electronics goods to show their wares to dealers, people who might sell them and take orders, which is why a lot of the things you see at CES are not, in fact, in manufacture yet. They're trying to see if they gauge the interest, and many of them won't be available till later in the year, if at all. So that's the bulk of it. There's 180,000 attendees, maybe 130,000 are... are dealers, people in the biz. But, of course, it's also a great media opportunity for these companies. And so CES does allow, here's the word, qualified press in. And you have to prove that you are qualified press. But as you point out, what does that mean these days when there's bloggers and YouTubers? I can't say for sure whether you'd be able to get this by them or not. But as far as I know, you know, for instance, we just sent them a link to our website and our shows, and you know, I say, well, I do this. Actually, the radio show pretty much qualifies me. But as a podcaster, if I didn't have the radio show, I would send them links to the show and say how many audience members and so forth. We've never had trouble getting media credentials, and those are free. And they give you access to a lot of stuff, including keynotes. And you can even get, which is a harder ticket, access to the big mini shows that precede CES. There's three of them, CES, Unveiled, Pepcom, and Showstoppers. Those companies aren't CES. They rent a ballroom, and they have companies pay $10,000 a booth to get access to the media. And then they lure the media with food. But they're actually stickier, in my opinion. I've had a hard time getting into those. Especially Pepcom, where the guy who runs it's very proprietary. So here's the deal. If you started the blog now, you wrote a lot. I don't think CES has ever asked me for audience numbers. So making it popular isn't necessarily important. But I think if you started now and really did file regularly, you'd have a pretty good chance of getting in.
Okay.
I think that's a great idea. So yeah. In other words, you really got to want to.
Yeah, it's just one of those things that, you know, it's wanted to go for about 20 years now, every year.
It's really cool. You should absolutely go.
Yeah.
The other way to get in is perhaps get to know somebody at one of these companies, because they have passes, too. You can sometimes go. So if you know somebody who does consumer electronics who's going to have a booth there, that's another way you can get in. It is an event. You know, people who go, and I include myself in this, and I'm going to Vegas for CES for decades. I didn't go in the last 5 years, but we even launched this radio show at CES back in 2004. People who do that often say, oh, I'm not going, thank goodness, this year, because it's a lot of work. But you know what? It's really fun. We're going next year for sure. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Sam Abu-Samid coming up. I'll put Scooter X's a link in the chat room. We'll put it in the show notes to the who can attend. And understand they make it a little, they make it sound scary. They want to scare people off. But they, you know, they don't say any specifics about media, particularly. Who can attend? Media badges will be granted to working media only. What does that mean? This includes broadcast media, industry analysts, key online influencers. That means somebody with a popular Instagram account or a YouTube account, online media, and print media. Media accreditation will not be granted to publishers, general managers, account managers, sales representatives, brand ambassadors, PR marketing, and non-editorial media professionals, or anyone whose principal purpose for attending CES for reasons other than covering it as working news media. Sam Abulsamid is here. He's a senior researcher at Navigant, where he covers the automotive industry. He's worked in the automotive industry his whole long life, and he's sitting in front of a classic blue Model S Tesla. That's a nice car, Sam.
Yeah, that was the first one I drove that had autopilot on it. Had the first generation autopilot system on it.
I drive a Model X with the second generation, and then I brought it in the other day, and I drove a Model 3, which is the third generation. On the second generation, you can't see cars to your left, to your right, behind you. So that kind of limits the self-driving features of it.
Absolutely.
But this one had cameras on the side, and I was amazed at what it could see. So Tesla had its analyst call this week. What did they say?
Yeah, they had their fourth quarter earnings call this week. They made some money, less profit than they did the quarter before.
But they're profitable, which is interesting. I didn't realize they were even profitable.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of questions about some of their accounting practices, though. I don't really want to get into that here. That's not what this show's about.
Yeah.
But what I do want to talk about is kind of continuing on from what we talked about last week. We got into driver assist systems last week, which is things like adaptive cruise control, lane keeping alerts, things like that.
Yeah.
And one of the things that Elon Musk said during the earnings call earlier this week was, you know, he referred to the latest iteration of autopilot, which has this feature they call navigate on autopilot, as being capable of full self-driving on highways.
He said this for years. He said, oh, pretty soon you'll be able to just get in the car and it'll drive you across the country.
Yeah. So, I just wanted to remind everybody out there that there today, there is not one single car that you can buy anywhere in the world that is fully self-driving. There is not a fully autonomous vehicle available for sale anywhere. And the only vehicles that come close to that are test vehicles that are being run by companies like Waymo and Ford and General Motors and a bunch of other companies.
There are areas of the country like Phoenix where you can hail, or not hail, but you can arrange a ride with a Waymo and drive in it. There'll be a safety driver in the front.
Yeah, but even those aren't, I mean, they're test vehicles, but they're not reliable enough to actually operate without a safety driver.
Right. They're licensed as test vehicles too. They're not licensed as, everyday cars. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, and I think, last week we mentioned, these SAE levels of automation, and there's two in particular, the top two levels 4 and 5, that are considered what we call highly automated vehicles. And that's kind of where you're getting into the realm of full self-driving.
I would like to never drive again. And I think, my kids feel the same way. I remember I used to talk pretty regularly to the CEO of Ford when before the current guy, Alan Mulally.
Alan Mulally.
Who was a great guy, very talkative. And I always would ask him, when's Ford going to do it? And he said, Leo, Americans like to drive. Well, I think that's changing. I think there's a few of us who don't want to drive.
Especially in cities. I mean, in cities, I don't think anybody really likes to drive in dense urban environments.
No.
And that's where you're going to see highly automated vehicles operating is in those kinds of environments where, increasingly people are using things like Uber and Lyft and other ride-hailing services.
Yeah.
Or micromobility. There was a micromobility conference in San Francisco this week.
Like scooters, you mean?
Yeah, scooters, e-scooters and bikes and things like that.
If people like to drive, Uber wouldn't be as successful as it is. People like let the car drive.
It's successful, but I don't think it's as successful as a lot of people think.
It doesn't make any money, but that's because it's so cheap.
It doesn't make money, but also less than 2% of all rides in the U.S. are ride hailing.
Oh, interesting. Oh,
yeah.
That's small.
So, I mean, 98% of all the rides are still in other forms of transportation. Right. But, you know, to do fully automated driving, like, you know, what everybody, you know, what the goal is for everybody, requires a lot more hardware and capability than is actually in any of the Teslas that are being built today that Elon claims will be someday fully capable of self-driving.
In other words, when he says the car you're buying today someday will self-drive, that's not true. It can't.
No, it's not.
It doesn't have enough hardware to do it.
Yeah, because, you know, in order to do fully self-driving or highly automated driving, you have to have a lot more redundancy than we have in any cars that are being built today.
Interesting.
You know, I mean, the traditional thing is, you know, if your power brake booster fails, the human driver is the redundant system. You just press harder on the brake pedal. If your power steering fails, you can still steer the car. You just turn harder on the steering wheel.
Right.
With an automated vehicle, you have a vehicle that is potentially capable of operating without a human on board at all.
So in fact, some of the concept cars don't even have steering wheels. Google won't put steering wheels and pedals in theirs. They say, you need a living room on wheels.
Prototypes. But the vehicles that they're operating today, the Chrysler Pacificas and soon the Jaguar I-Paces that they're
going to
be operating,
those
still have human controls in them.
Yeah, yeah.
So you have to have, you know, a lot of redundant systems in order for these things to be able to operate, you know, without a human taking over. Autopilot still requires the human to be paying attention and ready to take over. And the same goes for every other system from every other car maker. To have a fully self-driving vehicle, it's, you know, if something fails, the car has to be capable of getting itself to a safe place without relying on a human to take over control.
And we're not
And that doesn't exist in the cars that are out there today.
So let me ask you a question, because if I'm, you know, pricing out a Model 3. I know you're not a big Tesla fan. I've been pricing out a Model 3, and one of the options is for, I think it's $5,000 for future, if you ever want this to be, you know, it implies completely self-driving, you need to pay us now, so we'll put the equipment in. You're saying that's a con, or that I shouldn't pay that $5,000?
Yeah, so the $5,000 is for the enhanced autopilot capability.
Yes.
And in fact, they put the hardware that they put in every vehicle they build, the cameras, the radar, and the ultrasonic sensors. They put it in every vehicle, whether you buy the system or not.
Oh, interesting.
At the time of purchase, they charge you $5,000 if you want to turn on the software to control that.
But they say down the road at some point.
Well, yeah, but that's for
they don't have it yet.
Full self-driving option.
Yeah.
That's another $3,000 if you want that.
So what you're saying is I shouldn't probably pay that money up front.
Well, in fact, you can't anymore. A few months ago, they were charging $5,000 for the enhanced autopilot and another $3,000 for full self-driving, but they actually stopped offering the full self-driving option a few months ago. So you can't even get that.
Do they have a refund for the people who bought it?
No, they're still promising that they'll eventually get it, but, you know, we'll see what
happens.
Sounds like
you're skeptical.
Yeah. Well, just because I know what's in the cars, and they just don't have enough hardware in there to give you that level of safety that is required for a vehicle that can operate without a human in the vehicle.
Sam's trying to talk me out of buying a Model 3 when my lease runs out on my Model X. I think you might win. If I could get a Porsche Taycan, I might buy that. When is that's coming out in the fall, right? That's an electric vehicle from Porsche.
I think it goes on sale in Europe like in late spring, early summer, and then it'll be here in the U.S. in the fall.
That's not going to be self-driving either, though.
No, but it'll have capabilities similar to autopilot.
Interesting.
Yeah.
All right. So how do I get on the list to order one of those in the fall?
I'll
do you know anybody?
I'll connect you with somebody.
Seriously,
know,
I could see myself. I've never owned a Porsche, but I like electric vehicles a lot. I really do. I love my Tesla Model X, to be honest.
And there's a lot of great EVs coming to market, you know, in addition to.
Hey, can we talk about that next week? What the future
Absolutely.
Is? Because that's about to change dramatically. There's a handful of choices like the Nissan Leaf and the Chevy Volt, but there's going to be a bunch more in the next year.
Yeah,
Sam
well,
Abolsamid,
premium and affordable cars too.
He is a senior researcher at Navigant, which means he covers this day in, day out, and he joins us each week to talk about the future of driving, which may mean you're in the back seat. See, I'm getting old, Sam. I figure in the next...
You may be lying in a bed in the back.
10 years, can I be lying in bed in my car?
Probably not.
Oh, man. That's about when I want it. Leo LaPointe, the tech guy. More calls right after this. Oh, you're depressing.
Eventually, maybe someday.
Now, the more I look at that, so they have the e-tron now, right?
Yeah, the e-tron's already. But that's an SUV. Always delivering those in Europe.
I don't want an SUV.
Well, you know, it's an SUV. You know, like your Model X is. You know,
yeah.
It's
but that's what I mean.
It's a little bit taller. But, yeah. You know, it's more like a tall wagon than you know.
Yeah, I've seen pictures. You know, say like next year, they're going to have the e-tron, what is it, GT, the new?
They'll have the e-tron Sportback. Early next year, yeah. Which is based on the same platform, but it's more of a coupe-like body style. And then the e-tron GT comes out in 21, but the Taycan, which the e-tron GT is based on the Taycan, that's coming out this year.
Yeah, I would buy a Taycan. I really would.
But for Michael, you know, I think you guys should really take a look at the new Kia Niro EV.
Yeah, I've been seeing that. You like that one?
Yeah, it's really good.
Not as opposed to the Leaf, because that's what we're looking at for him is the Leaf.
Yeah, well, I think you know the Niro, you know, is got a little bit more room inside, and you know, since he's as tall as he is, he's probably going to want take his friends around.
Yeah.
I think you might find that one a little bit better, a little roomier inside, and it's definitely worth taking a look at. 240 mile range, I think.
Oh, that's nice. N-E-R-O?
N-I-R-O.
N-I-R-O. And what's the charging system? Is it CHAdeMO?
No, it's CCS.
It is CCS. See, that's the future, right?
Because Nissan's the only one using CHAdeMO.
So because of the Electrify America, CCS is the future for charging, right?
Well, Electrify America stations have CHAdeMO connectors, too. They have both.
Both. Are there more CHAdeMO? By the way, we went to Vegas over the weekend, or like the last couple of days, and I got in my car, and I guess the climate conditioning or something had depleted the battery to 50 miles. I thought, we're not going to get home. And we drove it to a supercharger right by the Oakland airport, had a little Chipotle. It was up to 150 miles. We whisked away. That's a nice fast charging. And the availability of those chargers really makes a difference with it.
No, it absolutely does. And that's the key thing that's going to be changing over the next couple of years is availability of more high-speed chargers from that support all the other EVs on the road.
So that's why when we look at a car, I think it's appropriate to look at the charging system, right? Because we want to make sure that it's going to be compatible with the future of fast charging. CHAdeMO will have fast charging as well?
Yeah, CHAdeMO is already fast charging. It's a Japanese fast charging standard.
Okay.
And then everybody else is using CCS.
And Electrify America is going to really have more CCS they support than CHAdeMO.
No, actually, they're
the other way around.
They're both. All their charge points have both connectors.
Kia Niro. I will tell Lisa that.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, if you're interested in taking a look at it, I mean, if you'd go to a Kia dealer and just check out they have it as a hybrid and a plug-in hybrid now, and then the EV version's coming next month. You can get an idea of what it's going to be like, and you know whether it's got enough room for you and things like that.
I will have her do that. She's really likes the Leaf, but we haven't looked at the Niro. So, yeah, and yeah, we're probably going to get that. When my lease runs out in July, I'll drive her ICE vehicle until I find something I like the Taycan.
Yeah, I'll talk to somebody there and have them get to drive them for.
Tech guy be talking all about the Taycan. I love my Taycan. I'd be saying, I'd put it on my forehead. Taycan.
And to computer copy. Yes, I know I've driven the Kona EV from Hyundai.
Oh, what do you think of the Kona? Yeah.
It's actually exactly the same powertrain as the Niro.
Okay.
Same battery and everything. It's a little bit smaller than the Niro. That's why I suggest, for you, either one is really good.
Or they look at the Kona. Or the Kona. Okay, cool.
Yeah, check out
the Niro's bigger. Yeah,
because you got a little more interior room.
Sam, you're the greatest. I really appreciate it.
I'm enjoying this.
All right. We'll talk next week.
All right. Talk to you next time.
Bye-bye. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 ask Leo, the phone number. Gary, Los Angeles. Hello, Gary.
Hi, Leo. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Fine. I had a question about my cell phone when I'm using it at home. I have it set to Wi-Fi preferred on the calls, and then all of a sudden it'll say it can't connect on the Wi-Fi, and I get it. Error code.
Oh man, that's frustrating.
And
who's your carrier, first of all?
T- T-Mobile.
Yeah, so T-Mobile does. So first of all, the carrier and the phone both have to support Wi-Fi calling. T-Mobile, actually, you know, I think in future all carriers will. They love it because you're riding on somebody else's network. You're not using their cell site, which reduces congestion. And they still charge you by the minute. So it's a win-win, right? So they love it. T-Mobile was one of the first to do it. I have a T-Mobile phone. I use Wi-Fi calling all the time. What kind of phone do you have?
I have a Motorola G5 Plus.
Nice phone. You happy with that? You like it?
Yes. And one other thing is I didn't seem to have this problem until the phone updated to the new operating system 8.1. And when I searched on the internet, I see where other people seem to think that that's why this is happening too.
Ah. Okay. So Oreo might have broken it. If that's the case, Motorola will put out a fix. So, I'm looking at this. At these posts that you mentioned. So I think certainly not having a compatible router, but you said it worked before. That could have been a problem or poor Wi-Fi. Of course, one of the things the phone's going to do is say, well, is there enough bandwidth for me to make a decent call?
Yeah.
But it sounds like it was all working until 8.1 came out.
I think so.
Yeah.
And I get different error codes. I'll get error 081, error 04, and this morning I got REG99.
Huh.
So
yeah, I'm seeing these in the Lenovo community. Lenovo, of course, makes that Moto.
Yeah.
As soon as I installed Android 8.1, I received an error message, unable to make calls over Wi-Fi. Never had this issue before. Error 82 is an indication your Wi-Fi may be working, but your internet may not be. The red, so the error codes are probably significant.
When I restart the phone, it'll connect back to the Wi-Fi.
Yeah, so you're using Wi-Fi data on the phone, just not Wi-Fi calling. Is that correct?
No, I have the set. I have the phone set to Wi-Fi calling preferred.
Yeah, no, I understand. But the question is, can you use Wi-Fi for other kinds of data, like email, surfing the web?
Probably.
Yeah, so that's the first thing to check, just to make sure the phone's getting the Wi-Fi. I'm looking at a Lenovo support thread that says exactly the same thing. He's got a Moto, T-Mobile. Red, they're getting the same error codes, 82, 99, 81. He says, restart of the phone resolves it till it fails again within a day. Now, one thing he said, which is a little weird, but it might be worth a try. If you know how to do this, on your router, you know, a router, that box that you connect to your cable modem, or your DSL modem, is the thing that shares the internet among multiple devices, your phone, your laptop, your desktop, your TV, and all of that stuff. But that's not the only thing a router does. It also acts somewhat as a firewall, because normally it sees traffic and it will route it to the, if you're watching Netflix, it'll say, oh, I see this Netflix traffic, and it'll route it to your TV. Same thing with your phone. But it can also act as a firewall if it gets traffic it doesn't recognize. And I'm seeing that on these threads, one fella says if he opens ports 4500 and 500 UDP in his router, it's resolved the issue. In fact, a number of people are saying this in this thread. Now, how to do this is a little complicated. It's kind of a black diamond tip. I'm going to put a link to the thread in the show notes at techguylabs.com so you can see the discussion. But also, let me tell you a little bit about how you might do this. And it's going to depend on the router you're using, whether it comes from the phone company or the cable company, or the DSL company, or you bought your own. They're all different, but there will be, and I'm sure you know about it, a way to log into your router from a computer via the browser. Typically, you'll enter an address like 192.1.1 or 192.162.1.1 or 1.0. It will depend, or 10. My Comcast business modem router. It's 10.0.1.0. I mean, it'll be an address that begins with 192 or 10. You enter that. You'll need to log in. If you haven't reset the password, which, by the way, is a very important thing to do, the manual for your router will say what the default password is. But often it's something like admin, admin. It's something so bad that you really want to change that. Once you're logged in there, look for port forwarding. That's what we're doing here is we're saying, hey, when traffic comes in, this is telling the router, if you get traffic at port 4500 or 500, which are unusual ports, if you get traffic at those ports, that's for the phone. Okay? I want you to route it. So I'm not sure. I mean, your phone might not have the same IP address every time it joins. So I'm not sure if it's actually port forwarding or the way that some of these people are saying is opening those ports. Open those ports on the router. That's just telling the router, look, if you get something on that port, that connection, let it through. Because that's, I want you to do that. I don't know if this is the right answer, but this is something that in the Lenovo forums, two people have said, yeah, this fixed it in that exact situation. I think probably what you're going to do, they don't mention this, is reserve an IP address for your phone. This gets even more complicated. Again, in the router, you'll say, look, when this Moto G5 gets on the router, it should always have 192.168.1.101 or whatever. And then port forward 4500 and 500, not with TCP, but UDP. Streaming voice usually uses UDP, which is a style of network traffic over TCP. And then port forward it to that reserved IP address that you said. This is the phone. This is always the phone. You know, this could be completely voodoo, but it's certainly worth a try. And it sounds like it's the kind of thing that an update broke on the G5 particularly. I haven't heard about it on other phones happening. And I of course, have an up-to-date Android phone. Actually, I'm on Android 9, but I've been using Wi-Fi calling. By the way, Wi-Fi calling is awesome. It sounds like the person's in the same room. It's amazing. So it's a worthwhile thing. Probably doesn't save you money. I think most carriers still charge you the per minute fee. Although if you have unlimited phone calls, and I think you probably do on T-Mobile, that won't bother you. Does not charge against your data anyway. There you go. There's a lot of... this is a tricky, advanced thing. If you're sophisticated enough to understand what I just said, you'd probably be able to figure it out. Probably have to reserve a port for the phone just so that you know what IP address that phone will be whenever it's on your home network. And once you've done that, then port forward ports 4500 and 500 over UDP. Man, I said I wouldn't be speaking geek on the show today. I'm so sorry. I ended up speaking geek. Apologize. Our show today brought to you by my buddies at do.co. Doco. No, that's DigitalOcean. Do. DigitalOcean.co. That's their short URL for one of the best companies ever when it comes to startups. People want to learn technology. DigitalOcean is a provider of high-speed servers. It's a cloud platform for developers and teams, for startups. You know, I remember when Kevin Rose started his company, Dig, right? Remember Dig? The late lamented Dig? Kevin was so excited. He said, we got our colo, which means they got a place, a network operations center. And we just got our server, so they had to buy a big expensive computer to put in the colo. Then they have to go over to the colo and they have to configure it, install, you know, Ubuntu or whatever he was using, install the software, configure it. Great problems associated with it. And that was, you know, what was that, 20 years ago? Even in 5 years ago, this was a big deal. When we first started Twit, when I first created my own website, a lot of what was involved was finding a server company and then in getting that server company to provision, that was the word they used, provision a server. And once they've provisioned the server, then, you know, a week later, you get to get your software on the server. I mean, it was just a nightmare. It is so much easier now. The world has changed,
and it's thanks to DigitalOcean. DigitalOcean can get you set up. You can go right now to do.co/twit. And you, by the way, when you do that, you'll get a $100 credit. They can get you set up running a server with a variety of operating systems or containers or even, and I'll show you this because I'll set it up right now. I like to do this during the ad. Let me just log into my DigitalOcean account. I'll show you. They can provision it, enterprise-grade SSDs, network operation centers all over the world in 55 seconds or less. Here, why don't we do it? So I'm on my DigitalOcean account. By the way, very affordable, 69 cents in usage. I killed the droplets I made the other day, so let me make a new droplet. What is a droplet? It's a server. It's an instance. Look, I can use Ubuntu, FreeBSD, Fedora, Debian, CentOS, or I can install containers on CoreOS, Fedora Atomic, Rancher OS. They support Kubernetes. They support Docker. And I love the one-click apps. This is the one I always do because it's so straightforward. You want to set up a LAMP stack on Ubuntu 18.04? All right, let's do it. That means I'll be ready to serve. Let's see, how much do we want to pay? Well, you get a choice. And by the way, you can always upgrade your server all the way up to 32 CPUs, a 4-terabyte SSD, 12 terabytes of transfer. But I always start small, the $5 a month, 0.7 cents an hour server. That's plenty for me, right? They also have CPU-optimized droplets. They have a lot of choices. For an extra buck a month, you can have backup if you want. You don't have to. You can add block storage. Choose your servers all over the world. New York, Amsterdam, Singapore, London, Frankfurt, Toronto, Bangalore. I always go with San Francisco. That's near me. But again, you might want it somewhere else. Depends on what you're going to do. You can choose IPv6, private networking. I always add an SSH key. That way I can log in quickly. You can name it, but I won't do it this time. Now, I've given it all the parameters. Let's create my server. This is how easy it is. I'm going to create a full LAMP stack so I can get in there. I can immediately, it's got Apache on it, so I can immediately post a site. I should do that in the next ad. 99.99% uptime SLA, cloud firewalls, full DNS management, 12 global data centers, free round-the-clock tech support, and it's very affordable. Did I say 0.7 cents an hour? That's what I said. Less than $5 a month. And by the way, we've got a free $100 credit waiting for you, so that makes it even more affordable. Join over 150,000 businesses. Including some, oh, it's done. My server's done. 178.128. Shall we log into the console just to prove it? All right. Let's log in. 150,000 businesses, some of the world's fastest growing startups. They rely on DigitalOcean to remove infrastructure friction and deliver industry leading price performance. Sign up today. There it is. That's my server. And I can log in with root access. Forget a week to provision. 55 seconds. It's, by the way, if you're learning Python, Django, Node.js, a lot of web technologies, if I were doing progressive web apps, which I plan to do, this is a great way to set up an inexpensive test bed for you that's public if you want it to be. do.co/twit. You'll get $100 credit right now. do.co. Isn't that awesome? /twit. DigitalOcean. Trusted by businesses, loved by developers, and hobbyists too, like me. And man, Kevin Rose would have loved this in the day. I'm sure, you know, when he starts up stuff now, it's DigitalOcean. do.co/twit. Try it today. Can I code? Oh, can I code? Oh, yeah, I've been coded for years. I coded for years. And I still code. What I'm doing is I'm relearning all my coding. I just worked my way through how to design programs, HTTP, which is Racket, a Lisp dialect. And I think for PWAs, I'm going to probably do them in Clojure, which is a Lisp that transcodes to Java or JavaScript. But I think now the next thing I want to do is Haskell. I've learned a little Haskell, but I think I want to really dive into Haskell. Coding's fun. I've written code for years. Wrote some of the first open source programs back in the day. When I had a bulletin board, I wrote the first multitasking app for the early Macintosh. This is back in maybe 93, 94. Maybe it was before then, maybe even. No, yeah, it was in the 80s, I guess. I used the vertical blank interval to do speed dialing. So it was an auto dialer to get into the bulletin board because I only had two modems. In those days, nobody had multiple lines for pre-internet. And that, I've done a lot of VB stuff. I'm not a fan of BASIC, but honestly, that's how I started, right? So, and VB's really amazing. VB's really amazing. But I really prefer functional programming and Lisps right now. Scala is very cool. Scala is very cool. I think Clojure to me is the most practical of languages because it's basically a Java front end, and it's a nice Lisp. Done Perl. C was my first real language after BASIC. Love C. C is a beautiful thing. Here we go. Perl, did a lot of Perl, a lot of Python. Love Python. In fact, if I were starting out today, I think probably Python. Although I think learning functional programming is a great start. Well, hey, how are you today? Good to see you. Leo Laporte here. Yeah, tech got time. Time to talk computers, the internet, home theater. We talk about digital photography. We talk about smartphones, smart watches. Chris Marquardt, our digital photography guru, still on vacation. He's on walkabout in New Zealand. I cannot wait to hear about that. He'll be back in about almost exactly a month. He'll be back in March. But meanwhile, that just gives us more time to talk high tech. 888-ASK-LEO is my phone number, 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. After that, outside of that area, you can always use Skype out to call. 888-ASK-LEO. Tom, Riverside, California is next. Hey, Tom, Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hello, Leo. I wanted to get some advice on a Chromebook. I've been looking at this Google Pixel a little bit.
Oh, that's a beautiful Chromebook. The Pixel Slate or the laptop Pixel?
What did you say?
So there's two different Pixel Chromebooks from Google now. One is a tablet, the Slate. That's their newest. But actually, the one I like and one I use is the Pixel Book.
Yeah, the Pixel Book is okay. The one I've looked at. Okay. And I don't know about the other one. I wanted something with a pen also that you can use. I wanted to also see about a service because I don't have a smartphone. I have a regular phone.
Yeah.
And I want something I can use it mobily, you know, to access the internet.
Yeah, so you want to have something that has an LTE chip in it. Of course, now don't forget that you will have to pay a subscription fee to a carrier for that. Usually it's not as expensive as a cell phone.
Yeah.
The Google Pixel Book is phenomenal. It does have a pen. It's an additional $99. I don't know if they make an LTE version or not. Have you seen whether they do?
I didn't know. Yeah. I haven't.
So that would be one question. It's weird because for a long time, everybody had LTE, and then all of a sudden everybody stopped. And I think that there was kind of this decision to just say, well, people will have everybody has a smartphone by now, not you obviously, but everybody else has a smartphone by now, and so they'll just use it as a hotspot. So we're not going to build those in anymore, and we'll save people money. That's turned around now. You're seeing more and more devices that do have LTE built in. So that's what you're going to be looking for. I'm looking at the Pixel Book. I don't think they have LTE. So I think that's going to eliminate that from your consideration. The other reason you might want to is it's the most expensive Chromebook out there. Now, you get quality for that price. So you're getting what you pay for. I think what I would look at, it's less expensive. It's down to $600. Does have a pen. And actually, one of the nice things about it is the pen is built, it comes with it and is built into it. So it slides into a little slot. So it's always there. They offer an LTE version. It's the Samsung Chromebook Plus.
Samsung Chromebook Plus. Okay.
It's $599 with LTE, which is a very good price. My daughter uses this in college. I bought a couple of these, and I really like them. I've tried many of the Chromebooks. There are lots of good ones. Acer also makes excellent Chromebooks. But but you mentioned the pen, and that's kind of one of Samsung's secret sauces. They love pens. So the Chromebook Plus comes with a built-in pen, and it also offers LTE. Plus, it's like the Pixelbook. It's what we call a two-in-one. It can fold all the way around, so you can use it like a tablet. Or you can tent it, which makes it great for watching movies and stuff like that. I think this is a good choice for you. I really like it. What are you going to do with it?
Just go on the internet and study. Basically, do research for different technology.
Yeah, this is perfect. This is basically an internet device. Sometimes people say, "Oh, I don't like Chromebooks because they require an internet connection." Well, you're going to always have one, right, with the LTE. "Oh, I don't like Chromebooks because I can't run Microsoft Office." Sounds like you don't care about that. What you do is browse the internet, email, anything you can do in the Chrome browser, you can do in a Chromebook. And here's the advantage of Chromebooks, besides being less expensive. This at $599, this thing is the same price as an iPad, but much more capable. It will run Android apps if you wanted to. But more importantly, with the Chrome extensions, it can do a whole lot of stuff, including photo editing, sound editing, even movie editing, video editing. Adobe is starting to create something called Adobe Rush, which is designed for Chromebooks. It lets you do video editing. So I honestly think these Chromebooks, and the real advantage is, besides price, they're super, super solid and very secure. So if you're doing banking, for instance, I know a lot of people just have a separate Chromebook just for their online banking to be safe.
Well, that would be that's not something I'm particularly got a lot of use of with, but it would be comforting to know that you're not going to have
a lot
of problems.
Yeah, no viruses. Yep.
Yeah, a lot of problems that you're going to get with surprises that you get with other things that you're not expecting. But now I'm going to apologize to you because I don't know. I got lost because I'm not very tech savvy. So
this is good. What a great way to start. This is a good way to start your tech adventure.
Yeah, the LTE now is I'm looking at service to get connected to the internet.
Yeah.
If you have the LTE, that does that for you. Is that what you're saying?
It does not. It merely puts the hardware in there that will let you then go to an internet carrier, it's really a cell phone carrier, and subscribe.
AT&T would be where I'm at right now.
So you would go to AT&T and say, "I want a SIM for my Chromebook." And they'd say, "Okay, fine, that'll be an extra $20 a month or whatever." If the other thing to price for sure for Chromebooks is Google's Fi, which is their own service. It uses T-Mobile, Sprint, U.S. Cellular, and Wi-Fi, so it'll use all four. And they make for free, they'll give you a data SIM that will go in this Chromebook. And then it's very affordable. It's $10 a gigabyte, so with a limit of $60 a month. So that's another way to go. But I would ask AT&T, what would you charge me to put a SIM in this? And since you already have an account with them, they just added onto your account.
Yeah, now the other thing is Hotspot that they sell. Is that...
No, don't do that. You don't need that. It is an alternative, and if it were cheaper, you could use it. The advantage of the Hotspot is it wouldn't just be for the Chromebook. You could put up to five devices attached to that same connection.
Yeah, and that's overkill for me. Yeah,
and this Chromebook can actually... I'm pretty sure this can also do hotspotting. So basically what you're doing is this Chromebook is... By the way, you could use it as a phone, too. Because you can use Skype or Google. I mean, there's voice video calling on this thing. It's got a camera. It could be your phone. Yeah. Once you get the LTE in there, it can be your phone. You're just using data for everything.
That would be good, too.
Yeah, I agree.
The other thing, what about a printer to go along with this that I can use?
Any printer that supports
you can use any, yeah.
Yeah, well, as long as you don't physically connect the printers to this. You have to use a technology called Google Cloud Print. Which means you can wirelessly print. So the problem with doing that is your printer has to have internet access. That's a little bit of a disadvantage for you, unless you go somewhere where you can get on the Wi-Fi and do that. So that's a little more tricky. I don't know. Let me ask. There are USB ports on here. Maybe you can print directly to a printer. I've never done that with a Chromebook. Anybody in the chat room ever printed directly using a USB connector? My guess is it doesn't have printer drivers. So that's tricky. It looks like, okay, if you get a wireless HP printer, says Greg Bilton in our chat room, there's a Chrome app, a Chrome OS app, in other words, a plug-in for your Chrome browser that will let you print directly. So, Greg, you can connect a USB cable to that HP printer and use the Chrome extension to print directly to it via a wire, because that's what he's going to need to do. That's the only thing. That's the only curveball you threw me there. Add your printer to the Chromebook. You can print from your Chromebook using most printers that connect to Wi-Fi or a wired network. You can also use a USB cable. So, yes, you can. So an HP printer would work for you. I bet you most printers would work. Just look for the ability to print from Chrome OS. And then you're going to have to get a cable. The printers these days don't even come with USB cables often. So you get a USB cable, you'll connect it to your Chromebook and then print that way. So you can. That's interesting. I've never seen it done that way. Epson will do it as well. All right. Epson's our sponsor. So buy an Epson printer. go with Epson. They're a good company. Oh, and they even have an eye projection app for Chromebook. Oh, interesting. All right. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 888-ASK. Leo, that's the phone number. 888-827-5536. We'll put everything we talk about up on the website, too. That's a free, no subscription, no sign-up even. Just go to techguylabs.com, and I'll put some links there. It looks like, as far as I can tell, I'll have to ask my friends at Epson, if you want to print from a Chromebook with a cable, you know, the old school, you pretty much have to use an HP printer because Chromebooks don't come with printer drivers. So, they're designed to print over the cloud with Google Cloud Print, and any printer can use Google Cloud Print wirelessly. But our last call didn't have internet, right? So this was going to be his one and only internet device, so Cloud Print won't solve that. I guess he probably could print to, a Kinko's. I bet you anything, they have Cloud Print-enabled printers, and you can print to them for a fee. If you didn't do a lot of printing, that'd work. But if you did want to have your own printer, HP makes a printer, I think it's very clever, that has a Chrome OS extension that works on a Chromebook. And then you just hook it up via a USB cable and you can print. It's kind of old-fashioned. But there are... I think this is one of the things the tech industry has done that is not good, which is assume that everyone has internet access. Yeah, everybody's got internet access. No problem. And not everybody has internet access. What if you're starting out? Just starting out. Bill in San Juan, Puerto Rico. Hello, Bill.
Good afternoon, Leo. Hope you're doing fine.
I hope you are. How are things in San Juan?
Things are rebuilding. Tourism is great this year. People should come down. It's going to take a couple years to get everything else fixed back up after Maria, but we're doing fine right now, Leo.
I'm happy to hear it. San Juan's one of my favorite Caribbean destinations. I just love Puerto Rico. And I was so heartbroken to hear about the troubles. So I'm very glad things are going well.
Well, they're going as good as can be, Leo.
Yeah.
Leo, I gave myself a Christmas present of a Canon EOS R with the 2870 f/2 lens.
Oh, are you a nice person?
Santa Claus is great. Yeah. And I'm going on a cruise in the Mediterranean this spring. And I want to know some tips so I can use to not get this thing stolen or ripped off.
Oh, man. Well, first of all, don't carry it. Okay, the very first thing I do, and I carry very expensive cameras, too, when I travel. In fact, I'll never forget I was in Buenos Aires after midnight. Beautiful city. Love walking around Argentina. And I'm carrying around my Canon 5D Mark III. Actually, it was probably a 5D Mark II back then. And just taking pictures, beautiful night, And somebody walks up to me, taps me on the shoulder and says, Senor, you should not be doing this. You are going to get robbed. I've never been mugged, hijacked, stolen. Nothing has ever been. I've traveled a lot, as you know, to many, many countries, and I've never had anything stolen, knock on wood. But here's some tips. Here's one of the things I would recommend. First of all, take that Canon strap right off. That's a big old advertisement, isn't it? You can buy better straps anyway on Amazon or whatever. The camera strap itself should be innocuous and not advertise the brand and make of the camera, because that's just saying, hey, over here, there's a nice camera over here. So that's step one. Step two, camouflage the camera. Sometimes I carry cameras that have very distinctive markings. Leica cameras, for instance, have a very distinctive big red dot on it. Now, if a camera, most thieves are not savvy. But if a camera thief sees that big red dot and knows what he's seeing, he's seeing an expensive camera, that may be more likely. So like a lot of photographers, I'll put black electrical tape over markings to kind of discourage people. You might even get a case. And if you carry your camera around your neck instead of over your shoulder like a pro, but around your neck like a tourist, and you have it in a case, it might look like just a cheap point-and-shoot tourist camera, less likely to get stolen. The biggest threat, though, and this happens, and it's happened to many, many friends, is you don't carry the camera. See, it's hard to steal it. They'd have to mug you or cut the strap and, you know, like a snatch it. So if you keep, you know, you keep your hands around and you keep your eye peeled, that's hard to do. But what often happens, people put stuff in bags, backpacks, bags. Of course, that's very convenient. And then they sit down at a cafe and they put the bag under the chair. That is a guaranteed to get stolen. Guaranteed. So I always keep my leg through a strap of the backpack or the bag if I'm not wearing it. That way nobody's going to slide it out from under me. There's another thing to be aware of. In some cities, there are very sophisticated pickpockets. My friend John C. Dvorak got robbed, I think it was in Barcelona. He was sitting at a cafe. He had a nice camera. He carries nice cameras, too, on a table. A little sweet old lady, tripped and fell onto his table in front of him, and he helped her up. And when by the time he got her back on his ways, her confederate had robbed him blind, took his wallet, took his camera, took everything. So be aware that there are, you know, that it is, you got to keep an eye on your stuff. On the other hand, don't be afraid. I carry very good, expensive cameras. I've carried them everywhere in the world, even stupidly after midnight in Buenos Aires, and I've never been robbed. I did, by the way, heed that advice and went home. But but I've never had any, knock on wood, never had anything stolen from me. And I think normal, really, the people who get robbed tend to be, they're just not paying attention. They're kind of, you know, so excited to be where they are. They put their bag under their chair and things like that. So disguise it, camouflage it, and then keep an eye on it.
Yeah, in Barcelona, I ended up with somebody's hand in my pocket.
Exactly.
In my pocket. So
a lot of pickpockets.
I know that.
Yeah.
And I'll do that. One unrelated question, Leo.
Sure.
I have a NAS, and I map network drives to the NAS.
Yeah.
And I tell Windows not to index it.
Okay.
Every time I restart the computer, it's indexing the files.
Doggone it. Dang, nab it. So yeah. They're mapped as a drive letter, and you've said to Windows, do not index drive E, but it still does it.
Yes.
Now, I'm going to have to punt on this one and ask our brain trust in the chat room and anybody listening, how do you keep Windows permanently from indexing a drive letter? Why is it when you restart it, it starts indexing it again? That's annoying. Keep listening. We'll see if we can get an answer for you. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Our show today, our podcast today, brought to you by Carbonite, the premier data protection platform for business. If you use a single provider for server backup, and then you use some other guy for your endpoint, you know, laptop and phone protection, then you use somebody else for your critical system protection, well, that's too complicated. And they're all going to end up blaming each other. And if disaster strikes, you got a bunch of calls to make or a lot of emails to send. That's why more companies are moving to a single vendor solution, and who better than Carbonite for all your data protection needs? Of course, Carbonite offers scalable, secure server backup solutions with flexible deployment models, flexible recovery options, real-time replication, and cloud failover. That way, you've got high availability. You can get back online in seconds, ready to go. They have backup and recovery for physical drives, but also for virtual machines, for cloud-based environments. No matter where your data lives, Carbonite can protect it. And they support everything. Over 200 operating systems, applications, platforms. Now, endpoint protection is an important deal, too, because you got data out there on laptops and on phones. Carbonite has enterprise-grade endpoint protection with end-to-end block-level encryption. That's important. That data shouldn't be sitting out there in public without encryption. 256-bit encryption, both at rest and as in transfer. And every data set has its own key. This is cool because it helps protect data from cyber attacks. Even if a key is broached, which is going to be hard to do, but even if it is, they only get a small subset of all the data. You get true global deduplication. That's one of the reasons they can do that, by the way. They've got the patent on this. Bandwidth management tools to minimize network disruption. And if that phone or laptop goes lost or missing or stolen, you've got remote wipe capabilities, so your data is safe. Here's the deal. Any business can do this. Combine Carbonite's technologies and build a comprehensive single-vendor solution for your workloads, your risk tolerance, your business objectives. Simplify your environment. Eliminate gaps in your data protection. Reduce costly redundancies. Carbonite. It's a secure, trusted provider with award-winning customer service 7 days a week. Look, all you got to do is find out more at Carbonite.com. Find out more about Carbonite's data protection platform for business. You know where to go. Carbonite.com. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888 Ask Leo, the phone number. We're going to put a couple of links in the show notes provided by the chat room to articles about how to get indexing turned off for an individual drive letter. It sounds to me like those articles will just say, do what you're already doing, which we know doesn't work. But, hey, look at them and see if there's any ideas. Ed thought maybe the best idea would be leave indexing on for that NAS, but have it index one empty folder, which will take no time. NAS, one of the reasons you wouldn't want indexing on a NAS drive, these are network-attached storage, and their chief feature is massive amounts of storage. It's a computer with no keyboard, mouse, or monitor, just big hard drives, usually many big hard drives. My NAS has, I think, 5 hard drives in it. And that means terabytes of storage. And, of course, Windows can really bog down trying to index all that. So I understand why you might not want that indexed. Besides, what you're not searching it. You're just there for backup or whatever. You don't need the index. Carol Rancho Cucamonga, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Carol.
Hey, Leo. Hey, I'm moving to Rancho Cucamonga, or the high desert, Victorville, Hesperia.
Oh, it's beautiful up there. You're going to love that.
Yeah. And the internet
but as with many beautiful areas, there's no internet up there. Yeah. So you've already checked around with people up there, and you know that there's not going to be enough internet up there for you?
Right. I did find a company that specializes in those kind of areas, Whisprin.
Yeah.
And
stands for Wireless Internet Service Provider, WISP. And they usually use microwave or some other wireless link to get, and sometimes they can give you very high-speed internet.
Yeah. Well, I'm interested in buying security cameras. I want wireless security cameras.
Of course you do, yeah.
And she told me I had to, she said something about a public static IP address, and it has to have intensive daily bandwidth requirements. Do you have any?
Yeah, so here's the deal with cameras, and I think people don't think about this. Internet-enabled cameras, and there are lots of companies that make these, send fairly high-quality images. If they're consistently recording all the time, they can use a lot of data. I think it's on our Nest cameras, which are always recording, 1.5 megabytes a second or a minute. It's a lot. Megabits. 1.5 megabits a minute. A second. So it's a lot of bandwidth. Now, we have a lot of bandwidth, but if you had, say, 5 megabits up, 1.5 megabits per second on a single camera would use a significant amount of your upload speed. I wouldn't worry about what she's talking about, the static IP address, unless you're not going to have, are you going to, when you, if you get this internet service provider, and by the way, before you decide, I'd recommend a trip to a website called broadbandreports.com. Broadbandreports.com. It is a great site for finding internet access by zip code and for reviews. So there are a lot of user reviews. So always do that before you sign up. Just check the reviews. And you might also use the zip code finder to see what else is there. Broadbandreports.com. But let's say you're going with this one. Are you not going to have a router?
I don't know.
I would imagine that...
At least they're at the house.
Yeah, most internet service providers... are you going to get internet service, or are you just getting it for these cameras?
I'm going to get internet for the cameras.
Just the cameras, not laptops, phones, anything else up there?
No.
Okay.
Well, I was thinking, I do have a Nest, one camera, and it works off of... It's wireless, and I've had it for years, and I love it.
So your only reason to get internet is for this Nest camera?
Yes.
Not for anything else? You don't want a laptop?
With the internet.
You don't want a laptop up there?
Not really. I'm going to try to sell the house.
Okay.
So it's going to be empty.
Okay.
And
you're only going to use one camera?
I want to get notified. No, I saw some packages. I checked out a lot of different makes and models of cameras. But I don't know which one to get.
All right. Well, we're not even there yet, and I'll help you. But we're not even there yet. So I understand why she said you need a static IP address. So here's the deal. Normally, when you have multiple internet-connected devices, you have a router. And the router is connected to the internet service provider, and it allows you to have more than one device connected at any given time. That's a nice feature. Because otherwise, each device has to have its own internet connection. So most people in their houses, I'm sure in your house, you have a router for your phone, laptop, computer, everything else. If you don't plan to, I would put a router up there. They're not expensive. Put a wireless router up there. You're going to need to, a Wi-Fi router, and then you don't have to worry about static IP addresses or anything else. These cameras, your Nest camera included, any camera that does Wi-Fi handles this just fine. So I presume that if you go with this internet service provider, and I think you should check reviews first, that they will provide you with an internet connection, and they may even provide you with your own router. If they don't, go out and get an inexpensive Wi-Fi router, ASUS, TP-Link. These are good companies. And then that way you can have multiple cameras. So that solves this static IP address. That's silly. Now, the next step is, that means you can get any camera that supports Wi-Fi. When you say wireless, do you mean no power either? Or is plugging it in okay?
Plugging in is okay.
Okay. You mean wireless internet. So, yeah, you're going to need a wireless router anyway, a Wi-Fi router anyway. She thought you might want to connect the camera directly to their service. You're not going to do that. You're going to have the service come to the house into a router, and then you can connect as many cameras as you want to the router. If you want full-time, like your Nest camera does, full-time streaming video, anytime you go to Nest, you know, mynest.com, you see video, that's going to be a megabit and a half for high def a second. That's a lot of data. There are cameras that only turn on when there's motion or noise, and those will use considerably less data. And you don't care if there's nobody moving around in there, right?
Right, and that's how I had my other camera hooked up.
Yeah.
Only when there was motion or noise, it would notify me on my phone.
So any camera, yeah, right. So that's the thing. If you don't, it'd be silly to have a camera constantly streaming if you're not watching it. What you need is a notification. Hey, there's somebody moving. You go there, and now the camera's on. I'm going to recommend a very good, inexpensive wireless camera system from a company called Wyze, W-Y-Z-E, the Wyze Cam. They make a couple of them. Get ready for this. They're $30.
Wow.
Actually, they're $20 for the basic one. And the one that looks around, that kind of patrols, it's called the Wyze Cam Pan. It's patrolling and looks around. It's $30, so you can get 10 of them. They use Wi-Fi. And they don't use a lot of bandwidth because they're not on unless they see motion, and then they'll notify you, and then you go using the app and check. So at that price, you could put them in every room. And the pan is great. I use one here because it looks around up and down. If it sees motion, then it notifies you through their app. The other advantage of the Wyze Cam is there's no monthly fee. You're paying a monthly fee for your Nest cameras, and that can really add up with a lot of cameras. Most camera systems, if they're not recording locally, and yours won't be, if they're recording to the internet, you charge a monthly fee, not the Wyze Cam. So go to WYZECAM.com and take a look at these. And they're fantastic. They're cheap, but they get the job done. You will need a wireless access point for them to connect to. And you'll run the Wyze app on your phone. That's how you get notified. They are not, if you want them to record all the time, they will do that locally. You put a little micro SD card in there. So that doesn't use any bandwidth at all. And if you go up to the house every once in a while, you check the card. But you don't have to do that. You can just let them be on the internet. And when you go to them, they'll turn on. So when they notify you because they've seen motion, you turn them on, and that's when you get the bandwidth. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888-ASK-LEO. So I recommended the Wyze Cam, W-Y-Z-E Cam, and the chat room lit up. I guess everybody, they're all Wyze guys in there. Everybody in there is using them. Scooter XR Mod says, I put a 64 gig micro SD card in mine that records for 5 days in high quality. One of my, our studio engineer, our programmer, Patrick, has a newborn, and he uses his Wyze Cam as a baby camera, does time lapses for him. But the nice thing about these Wyze Cams is they're, I think, economical, not merely because they're only $20 or $30, depending on the model you get, but there's no monthly fee, no subscription. Most other cameras charge you. But as a result, they don't store your video on the internet. Wyze Cam doesn't have an account you can log into and see all your video. So I think a lot of people would say, well, that's fine. I don't want them to store my video. You can see the video anytime by going to the Wyze app on your phone, and it'll turn the camera on. And so if it gave you a notification, it does audio and video alerts for movement or sound. If it gave you a notification, you can then look at it, and then it'll turn on the internet. It only uses it then. And if you want, it'll record locally to the SD card. You know, I can't see anything against it. Somebody said, well, then the Chinese get your video. Actually, Wyze is an American company. They're based in Seattle. Now, like all of these, I'm sure the camera itself is made in China. And in fact, I would bet that this is a standard platform that other companies like Xiaomi offers these YiCam with very similar features. Probably these are all the same. But I think, you know, privacy concerns are considerably reduced by the fact that Wyze isn't storing video for you. So I think pretty much thumbs up with everybody in our chat room who's using the Wyze camera. No negatives on there. Everybody seems to like it. $29 for the pan version, $20 for the regular version. And Wyze themselves said, yeah, we don't make a lot of money on a camera, but we want to sell a lot of them. And they have. They have. There's no web interface. You have to use a smartphone app or use the SD card for local recording. So that's just something to be aware of. But I think for your purposes, recording in a house that you're going to leave vacant while you sell it, this is a great choice. And you have to use a lot of bandwidth for it. 8888-ASK-LEO. That's the number if you want to call and talk high tech. I'd love to talk high tech with you. We're going to line one. That's Ron in Hayden, Colorado. Hello, Ron.
Hi, Leo. It's been a long time since I wanted to talk with you. I've got two major questions.
Okay.
The first one, I've got an old iPod 4 that I bought mainly for MP3s. And taking them from a Windows directory, it put them in nicely.
Yeah.
When I went to put all my photos in, it threw them into one folder. So I've got 60,000.
Oh, geez.
In one folder, and they don't give you an opportunity to... to use the, I've got four or five folder deep on Windows, but
so let me ask you about this. So this is an iPod Touch, right? The fourth generation iPod Touch.
Yeah, old one.
So the photos are pictures you took with the iPod.
Oh no, these were taken with regular cameras, Nikon.
Okay, but you stored them on the iPod.
Correct.
Okay, just so you'd have them and you could show them to people, things like that.
But they didn't bring the folders. Since I've got four.
No, it doesn't work that way.
No.
That's called iOS. So the thing to understand about Apple's iOS operating system, it's not like a computer. It is a computer. You knew and I know it's a computer, and it, in fact, has a file system and it has folders, but it does not expose that to the individual, to the user. It's hidden. So when you copy files over, photos over to the iPod Touch, the only way you can see them is through the Photos app, the Apple Photos app. And any organization you want to do, you have to do inside the Photos app by hand.
Oh.
You can't copy your Windows file structure over, or your Mac file structure for that matter, over. You're only copying the photos over, and then Apple's Photos app is handling it from there. And that's because Apple doesn't want users to have access to the file system. They think that's too complicated.
Now, I'm limited eyesight. I want to buy a new one. And I would like it to be able to transfer the four or five deep folders from Windows onto whatever device
I buy. Won't happen. Not on an iPod. So you're going to need to get something that is more less user-friendly, more geek-friendly.
Right.
If I could put it that way. So
recommendations.
Yeah, and you want to be able to view these files, obviously.
Yeah, I said, limited eyesight, so I like a big screen.
Okay. You're not putting them there just for backup. You're putting them there so that you can bring them around and show them and take a look at them.
Correct.
So there are a lot of products like this that are just for photos. Do you want to use music and other stuff, too?
I would like to, you know, put the MP3s and music on a portable device.
So there is a whole category of products. I call them photo wallets. They're designed for photographers. As you're photographing, you copy them over. It's basically a hard drive with a display. Those would work just for photos. If you want to do music and other stuff, well, now at this point, you're talking a tablet or a computer, not an iOS tablet.
Right.
Because you're going to have the same exact problem with an iPad.
I want to go to a smartphone...
Not an iOS smartphone.
Right.
Let me think. If you did this... You're probably going to want to get a computer, believe it or not, a tablet computer. And there are some nice ones, depending on the size of your purse. And I don't mean for carrying. I mean for money. The amount of money in your wallet. For instance, Microsoft makes a very nice little... tablet called the Surface Go that is a Windows, and it would absolutely honor your file organization. It would play MP3s because Windows can do it. It'd do everything your Windows machine could do, but it's a tablet sized.
Okay, now that brings me to the other major question.
Yeah.
I have a number of tablets. The iPod 4 iHeartRadio turned that off.
Yeah.
Lenovo, an old one, it's off. The first Kindle I bought, iHeart turned them off. The second Kindle I have, it works.
The issue is, of course, the age of the hardware and the operating system. And at some point, I don't have anything to do with iHeart. I work for iHeart Radio because that's who syndicates this show, but I don't have anything to do with the software. I don't have any insight into what they're doing, but it's very common that a program is just not going to support older operating systems after a while. They cut them off.
I bought it, and 3 months later, they stopped letting me.
I can't speak for them in any way. I think that's a shame because I want you to be able to listen.
The Surface.
The Surface Go, which is not as small as an iPod Touch, but I think it's pretty portable, pretty carryable. I love them.
Well, if it's like a 7-inch,
it's 10 inches. It's a little bigger, but it's like an iPad, basically. It's the iPad. It's their iPad competitor.
Okay.
The iPad price starts at $400. It is Windows. So anything you do with Windows now on your desktop, you can do on a Surface Go. They sell a keyboard attachment, too, which is kind of cool. You don't have to have that, but they sell that. So you can even make it a little laptop. I think this is a perfect application for that. It's touch screen. It would show photos. Because your vision's low, it would be great. You'd see them in a much larger size. They'd look great. There are other tablets that are similar, but I think a Windows tablet is going to be better for you than Android or iOS.
Yeah, it just surprises me that models like the Kindle, the first Kindle was discontinued and it won't run certain things, and the second one works fine.
I know.
Make you buy a new one.
Guess what? That's the plan.
Oh, yeah.
It's called planned obsolescence. I disagree with it. It means there's a lot more devices that are perfectly functional in the landfill. And it's not that the chip is worn out. They don't wear out. That's the problem for these companies. They don't wear out.
I got a BlackBerry cheap, and the only thing I use it for now is in a digital clock and a calculator.
The good news is Microsoft says Windows 10 is the last version of Windows. They're going to keep it up to date. If you buy a Surface, that thing's going to be good for at least 5 years, probably 10, just like any PC. And you can run MP3s, you can watch movies, you can put pictures on it. Any folder structure you have on your Windows PC, you'll be honored. I think it's probably the best way to go for you.
Okay, because I just bought a Lenovo 15-inch.
Well, that's the same thing. It's just a laptop. It's bigger.
Yeah.
But the Surface Go is a little smaller, and it's just, the Lenovo would do all of these things too. I'm not saying you need to get that small, but and there are 8-inch Windows tablets. I'm not sure I recommend them, but I think the Surface Go is the right one, and a good price too. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Yeah, Speech. That's because you're using Apple's Photos, and the organization you did is not a folder structure on the desktop or in the file folders, but in Apple Photos, and that does get propagated over. He's on a Windows machine where he has taken his photos. He's got a folder called Photos in there. He's got a folder called 1999, 1998. He's got different names of folders. He's got a whole folder structure. There's no way to propagate that over to iOS. Yeah, so the way we do this, FOMO, is, and it's a little weird. Call screening's up here, so Kim's up here. When we first started, call screening was down there, but unfortunately, we had a lot of delay doing it that way. So that was because the calls went to Sherman Oaks, which is where the Premier Radio Network Operations Center and studios are in Sherman Oaks. And so same thing with Rush, same thing with Hannity. A lot of these guys, like me, they're not in that facility. They use, as I do, an ISDN line or something like it to send the audio there. But what we found is if the calls are coming into the studio in Sherman Oaks where the call screener is, that's how Gina worked. She was down there. There's delay in the call, and so we were having all sorts of echo in the calls. So after a lot of trial and error, we ended up moving the calls up here. So the calls are coming in locally in Petaluma. They're coming into my studio. The call screening is done as a result, has to be done up here. There's no echo that way. That solved that problem. But then we send that mixed thing, which is the call plus me, down via ISDN to Big Pee Wee at Sherman Oaks. He's running the board down there. He's the music you hear, that's coming from Sherman Oaks. Everything, all the other production elements, the music, the network ads, all of those are coming from Sherman Oaks. He sends those back up via ISDN to me so I can play them for you and put them in the podcast or whatever. Actually, the podcast only has the Petaluma end of it. There's nothing from Sherman Oaks except, not even Big Pee-wee, not even when he talks to me. That does not end up in the podcast, I think. Only the local stuff goes in the podcast. And then, but going out to the satellite, the network, it's a mix of what's I'm sending down there and he's mixing in, and he puts that up in the network operations center and they put it up on the satellite. So that's how it works. I'm remote, in other words, via ISDN. Boz, I wouldn't want to try to get an ISDN line anymore. I think we got this one put in, how long is it ago? 3 years, 2 or 3 years, 2.5 years ago. And we were able to get it from AT&T and Petaluma. But they're slowly phasing those switches out. They don't want to have those switches. When I do radio at home, I do it not via ISDN, but over the internet using something called Comrex. The reason ISDN is better, it's not as high speed as the internet. It's only 128 megabits, but it's point-to-point. When I use the Comrex over the internet, it's over the public internet, and if there's slowdowns in the public internet, packets get dropped and stuff. So potentially it's higher quality because it's got more bandwidth, but you will find sometimes there's dropouts. I do it wired on my Comcast business class connection. But sometimes there's delay and dropouts, all the kinds of stuff you get on Skype calls when the internet's bad. It's very similar. Comrex uses some proprietary codecs. It doesn't use standard internet codecs. No, it's 128 kilobits. Did I say megabits? Yeah, it's not that fast. I wish it were. 128 kilobits. I'm sorry. Yeah, ISDN's very slow. It's 264K lines. KBPS. Yeah, it'd be crazy to get a leased line. You know, you used to be able to get T1 lines, remember? You know how fast a T1 is? 1.44 megabits. It's not fast. ISDN's 128 kilobits. Not fast. So leased lines, all of that stuff, you know. I imagine you can still get things like OC3, but it's all changed now. Mostly because they don't want to run these legacy switches. Everything's optical and, OC is optical carrier, but I just don't know if you can get that anymore. OC1 was Sonnet. 51 megabits. OC3, 155 megabits. That used to be so expensive. Now we get it kind of typically. And what we have here is fiber into the studio at 10 gigabits. I'm sorry. Symmetric. 10 gigabits each way from Sonic. That's like faster than OC48. It's OC192, which I've never even heard of. Wow. I suppose that's what Sonic is doing. I don't know. The good news about the ISDN is it's a phone call. It's a digital phone call, but it's a phone call. So it's pretty serious. We do have, I wish I could show you, but I don't think you can see it in this shot. No, you can't. But we have two ISDN Telos Zephyr boxes. So if one drops, we have the second one as backup. And they're both connected right now. So we're pretty good. And that has happened. It happens disturbingly frequently. Well, hey, how are you today? Time to talk tech. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, computers, the internet, home theater. We talk digital photography. We talk smartphones, smart cars, anything with a chip in it. The modern world that is rapidly approaching. 888-ASK-LEO is the phone number. 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. and Canada. If you're outside that area, you can still call. But you going to have to use Skype out or something like that. It'll be toll-free. 888-ASK-LEO. The great William Gibson, novelist, writer of, I think, one of my favorite science fiction novels of all time, Neuromancer. Back in 1984, he kind of predicted the future with Neuromancer, including, you know, virtual reality and, ability to get any. This was a big deal. In 1984, this sounded impossible, but I remember very well reading Neuromancer back then, thinking, yeah, someday we'll have this. The idea that you could have a tablet, little device, laptop-sized device, that would have all the world's knowledge on it. the entire Library of Congress. What he didn't understand was it wouldn't be on that device. Maybe it will someday, but I don't think so, because it changes too fast. You just connected. No one imagined that we'd all be constantly connected to the internet no matter where we are. That's an amazing thing. And via the internet, be able to access, all the world's knowledge pretty much. A great, great portion of it, more than you'd ever need. Gibson's the guy who said, the future's already here. It's just not very evenly distributed. And that's the case, right? I could talk about the future. For some of us, that's getting a fourth generation iPod Touch to store the music like I want to. For others of us, it's like getting a car that'll drive me home while I sleep in the back. It's here. It's just not very evenly distributed. Sandeep on the line from Orlando, Florida, where the future is now. Hello, Sandeep.
Yeah, I'm not at Epcot, but anyway.
Wasn't that the city of the future, right?
Yeah,
city
no,
of tomorrow.
Some, yeah, now they call it like the experimental prototype community of like yesterday. Or
yeah, the other day.
The local call.
Last decade. What can I do for you, sir?
So I was about to buy a Ring video doorbell, and then that whole issue with privacy.
Yeah.
So now I'm not sure what to get.
Yeah, well, I think probably it's safe to get a Ring after that became publicized. So Ring, by the way, Ring for a long time was a sponsor. I'm a Ring user. I have a Ring at home. We found out, though, that this is before Amazon bought them, and it's Amazon now. Before Amazon bought them, they were in such a hurry to get artificial intelligence built into the Ring so that it could recognize that's a human ringing the doorbell, it's a dog ringing the doorbell, whatever, so it could recognize what's out front. A lot of cameras claim to have that kind of capability. Most don't do a very good job of it. They were in such a hurry at the time that the founder of Ring, they had hired a team in Ukraine. And at the time, Jamie Siminoff, who was the founder of Ring, was in the Ukraine, and they said, well, it would really help us. We could actually teach it face recognition and that kind of thing, but we need the videos. And Siminoff, probably not thinking, he's a good guy. I really like Jamie. Fan of the show, by the way. So, Jamie, if you're listening, I don't blame you on this, but I understand, and I understand how it happened. But he said, hey, that's a great idea. We can train our doorbells to do better recognition. Let me give you the keys to where we've got all these videos stored. And that's a real cause for concern for any country, but giving it to a team in Ukraine is really, for a lot of people, a real, it's like, oh my, you know, maybe China would be worse, but there's not many places it'd be worse. So, those engineers had free access to all the videos from all the Ring doorbells. They could share them. That was another problem. They weren't controlled. They could all gather around a machine and watch them. Now, an outside doorbell video, there's not much there to watch. Although Ring has later sold indoor cameras, that would be a bigger cause for concern. Amazon, after that, bought Ring. And Amazon was quick to say, we don't do that anymore. They never denied that that had happened, but they said, oh, we don't do it anymore. So I think, in a way, it's better to use a company that's been caught than a company that may be doing it but hasn't been caught yet. So there are a lot of very good. Nest now makes a doorbell. I hear that's a very good doorbell. There have been other companies like Skybell. Well, as I said, I'm a Ring user, and I've been very happy with it. I think if I were entering the market today, I probably would buy the Nest because, well, Nest is Google. Now, Google's security, in my opinion, Google's security is very good. Google would never have said, oh, yeah, you guys here, take the video. They know better than that. You know, in Jamie's defense, I mean, he was a startup guy. They're moving fast, all that stuff. I think the choice is, so Skybell's been around for a long time. Ring's been around for a long time. The newer entries are the Nest. There's August, which is a well-known company for Bluetooth door locks, also makes a doorbell. I think I'd probably go with the Nest Hello if it were me today. But I'm not getting rid of my Ring. I'm very happy with it. I love it. There's a lot to be said for having a camera on your doorbell. You'll get notifications when somebody comes up the stoop. You'll get notifications when somebody rings the doorbell. You can speak to them and hear them. So this happens a lot. I use it also to monitor who's coming and going in my house. You know, if we have workmen coming over or whatever, I know when they started, when they stopped. If our kids come in, I know when they got home. You got home at 3 a.m. No, I didn't. I have the video. Things like that. And it's really great for package delivery. You know, the UPS driver comes and I can say, hey, I'm in the bathtub, just leave it on the porch and I can keep an eye on it. There's lots of benefit to it. I think a good place to put a doorbell. And really, honestly, who cares if somebody can see your front stoop?
Mm-hmm.
honestly. I don't, yeah. There's nothing much there.
I basically was just going to use it because I travel for work where I may be gone for 2 weeks. And
perfect.
I try to put the hold, you know, like vacation hold on UPS and FedEx, but sometimes it just doesn't work. Yeah. And then, you know, if I'm at, you know, in Wyoming, let's just say, I can talk to the
that's
UPS
right.
driver, say, okay, you know, whatever.
They ring the doorbell, you say, hey, please don't leave it here. I'm not going to be back for 2 weeks. Put it on hold, and I'll pick it up in a couple of weeks. That's a very, very, very good use for it. I think it's great. Ring also has a neighborhood feature where you do allow others to see in your neighborhood to see your videos, and I've found that very useful. People in my neighborhood will say, hey, yeah, there's a guy walking around 3 a.m, here's his video. And that's all of that I think is good. I'm a big fan, and I continue to use the Ring. I don't have any plans to change. If I were considering another company, certainly Google is going to have a high level of security. I think Amazon also is going to have a high level of security. I don't think Amazon's going to let that happen anymore. They got caught. Sometimes it's better to use a company that got caught. Hey, I appreciate the question, though. I highly Thank recommend them. Easy to install. They work great. And it's really nice to have that video. I completely agree. 8888 Ask Leo, the phone number. More calls still to come. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Our show today brought to you by my blog host. Actually, more than just my blog host, WordPress.com. WordPress hosts 33% of all the internet. Wait a minute. That can't be right. WordPress now powers 1/3 of the internet worldwide. That's how big WordPress is. I started using WordPress when Matt Mullenweg created it back in the 2000s. I've been a WordPress.com user for 12 years, and I'll tell you why. They do the hosting. They do the tech support. They do the security updates. They do it all. All I have to think about is putting my great stuff out there to the world. You can visit my WordPress blog, leolaporte.com. But look, I'm not the only one. As I said, 33% of the world uses WordPress. And WordPress.com is a favorite among some of the biggest publishing sites in the world, like Fortune, like Quartz.com, or QZ. I think WordPress is amazing. Powerful site-building tools, but you don't have to be a geek. You don't have to be an expert. You just have to have something to say, whether it's a business, an individual. And your content is your content. You can upload anything, images, pictures, videos, audio to WordPress.com. Download it anytime you want. It's your site, your content. It's your feel and look. WordPress is awesome. WordPress.com was started so that anyone could publish their ideas. No 2-week trials, no hidden fees, and you own your own content forever. It's free to start, but it's got plenty of room to grow. I use the business account because I love all the features. The support team, too, by the way, they're great. Actual WordPress experts, 24 hours a day, including weekends, always there to help you. It's flexible, it's powerful, it's good looking, and it's easy. I really want to underscore that. If you're a business and you've been putting it off because it's too hard, or you've got a junky site at one of those, I won't name names, bad site companies, just go to WordPress.com. You'll be glad you did. It's easy, it's very good, never down. And man, it looks great. WordPress.com. Actually, if you go to WordPress.com/techguy, you'll get 15% off any new plan purchase right now. That's a good deal. WordPress.com/techguy. 15% off your new website. I'm a 12-year member of WordPress. 12 years I've been using it, and I've never been happier. WordPress.com/techguy. Thank them when you're there for supporting the Tech Guy podcast, too. They make that all possible. 8888-ASK-LEO, the phone number. Joe in Chickatawaga, New York. I love just saying Chickatawaga. Hello, Joe.
Hi, Leo.
Welcome.
Got a little dilemma. I'm having a little trouble with my internet line. I think I'm experiencing a lot of packet loss. And I'll tell you what, I have a monitor set up at DSLReports.com.
Oh, good. Love that site.
And yeah, it's showing me a good graph of, okay, here's your round trip time, here's your packet loss, all that. My concern is that from what I see on that site, it may go away in a few months. There's features of that site that people are saying, okay, here's a bug in your site, and it doesn't get fixed.
Hmm. I don't know anything about that. I'm a big fan. I would be very sad. In fact, you heard me recommend it just last hour to somebody who was looking for a review of ISPs.
Sure. I love their forums. You know, I love that service and monitoring it. But based upon what I see, I have to wonder, are there other services like that that will give you basic IP monitoring?
Here's what I'm going to suggest. And this is whenever I talk to somebody, and by the way, this comes up a lot because, as you may know, we use Skype for a lot of our shows. A lot of our hosts are all over the world, from Taiwan to Boston and elsewhere. And so we're using Skype, and we often have to diagnose issues. And so there's a really good service that I use that is better than a bandwidth test. And it comes out of the University of California at Berkeley, their ICSI, their Computer Science Research Division. They're doing research on the International Computer Science Institute, research on internet, and they've offer, you know, the drawback is it's in Java. Although there is an Android app for it you can use as well. It's called Netalyzer. It's Netalyzer, netalyzer.icsi.berkeley.edu. But you know what? Just Google Netalyzer, N-E-T-A-L-Y-Z-R. Now, it takes a while to run. It's much more than a speed test. It will tell you about buffer bloat. It will tell you about packet loss. It will tell you about jitter. And it does it in a very accurate way because it's running a Java app to do it. And I think it's a much more useful tool than anything. Even I, by the way, I use the broadband reports all the time, but I use it for a plain old speed test. Netalyzer, if I need to, if we've got somebody on who's just, you know, having trouble for some reason, then we will have them use Netalyzer. The drawback is it requires you to enable the Java plugin architecture for your browser. And that isn't always a good idea. I would, you know, they'll explain how to do that and how to uninstall, how to kind of turn it off after you use it. The other way to do this is on an Android device. They do offer an app. They can't do it on iOS because Apple won't give access to any app to that kind of information. But, yeah. So it's a non-commercial university project, which means it's reliable and trustworthy. I think they give you the best information possible. I don't think Broadband Reports is going anywhere. I hope they're not. By the way,
they're a real good site.
They're great. I use the Broadband Reports and DSL Reports interchangeably, as do they. For years, they were DSL Reports, and they thought, well, yeah, we should call ourselves Broadband Reports. They did that for a while. Now that I see they're back to DSL Reports, I don't know. I guess it's all broadband. It's not just DSL. So,
well, the reason that happened is because Justin built up his reputation, and all the Google results were pointed toward DSL Reports. There was nothing. If he changed it to strictly Broadband Reports, it's like he would disappear from the internet.
Yeah, you lose your Google juice. Yeah.
Yeah.
So now recently I've been using a number of other speed tests. Everybody knows about the Ookla. Or Ookla speed test, which is speedtest.net. Yeah. But there are others. Netflix has one that's kind of good called Fast. It's at fast.com. It tests your connection to Netflix. It doesn't give you as much information, but there now have they? Yeah. So once you run it, and by the way, I just ran it on my laptop and I got 1.2 gigabits, which is very nice. You can do show more info, which will give you latency and upload speeds as well. So that gives you a little bit more info than it used to. That's fast.com. And that's, I like that because it's testing your connection to Netflix, which will give you some idea of how Netflix will work for you. The one of the biggest issues with speed tests in general is almost all of them are related to a carrier. Or, for instance, I'm on Comcast at home. Comcast is going to make deals with them or make sure that when they see speedtest.net coming in, they give it more speed. So you kind of want to stay ahead of these guys. Lately, I've been using one that doesn't require Java or Flash. It's HTML5. It's got a great name, speedof.me. Speed, which is, I think, a fabulous name. Yeah. Isn't that a great name? Speedof.me. And that's another one to run. I think there is no one perfect speed test. So I will run Broadband Reports. I will run Ookla's speedtest.net, and I will run Speed of Me.
Comcast, Verizon, Charter.
Yeah, they all have them. Test them all just to see, because really what you're looking for is what's the worst, not the best. And then I would absolutely, if you want to understand packet loss or other issues with your network, which you do, I know that's why you called.
Well, it's the thing is, it's sporadic. So it's like I'll have a few hours of absolutely great, and then it'll get all junky. What I'm looking for really is a monitor service like DSL Reports.
Ah.
So I can, you know, continuously, you know, every few minutes. Every 10 minutes.
Many routers have logging ability that will give you this kind of information. Otherwise, you're going to have to run a program on your computer that will do that. And there are a lot of good, if you're on Windows anyway, less so on the Mac, but there are a lot of good choices on Windows, including Insider, Insider. Linux, yeah, I think Insider runs on Linux as well. They're very good Linux tools. I don't know off the top of my head, though, what you would run, because you want it logging, so you want it running all the time in the background on a Linux machine. Let's ask the chat room for advice on that. That's a great question. What's a great program for Linux to monitor his, particularly his packet loss or jitter? We'll find that for you. Keep listening or check the website, techguylabs.com. The future of 1,000 years, my friends. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. That's what it is right now. You're looking into the future. You're seeing the future, and it's full of geeks. 8888 Ask Leo. That's the phone number. 888-827-5536. You know what we'll do on the show notes? I think we should compile a list of great speed tests. This new one that is really kind of fun for me. What did I say it was? Speed of Me? I love that. But there are others. There are lots. So if you have a good speed test, go to techguylabs.com, add it in the comments. And then I think we'll compile a few from the chat room. There were quite a few in the chat room. But this new one I've been using lately, I like a lot. And you can use it on a mobile device as well as a desktop or a laptop, even a tablet. Speedof.me. I'm kind of a fan. Laverne in the Bronx. Hello, Laverne.
Hi, Leo. I'm actually not calling from the Bronx today, so don't ask me about the cold because it's 61 degrees where I am right now.
Oh, I am so happy for you, Laverne. I'm glad you're not freezing your Laverne off. That would be terrible.
That's a good one. I have a question, Leo.
Yes.
Before I made my current trip, what I had done was I had added a second Yubico key to my Gmail account as a backup.
Good.
My problem is that on this trip, I'm not carrying a computer. I have a smartphone and an iPad. I know that the Yubico key doesn't work with the iPad. But my question is, because I bought the second key, which has an NFC chip in it that will work with the phone.
Yes, it will.
When I try to log into my secondary account to check to make sure that the Yubico key will work, I get an error message. So I wanted to know if it's the key. Should I contact Yubico?
No.
Or should I contact Google on this one?
And this is an Android device, obviously. Not.
Yes, it is.
Because Apple doesn't give you, unfortunately, NFC access for the YubiKey. So I should explain what we're talking about here before we go too much farther. YubiKey, which is a thing that comes from a company called Yubico, Y-U-B-I-C-O, is really a great way to secure your accounts. We've talked before about two-factor or two-step authentication. The idea being, Laverne's got a Gmail account. That's like that's the keys to the kingdom, that password, that Gmail account, because if a bad guy wanted to hack Laverne, what he would do is figure out how to get into her Gmail account and then go to all her other accounts and say, oh, I forgot my password. Would you email her a reset? And if he's got access to the Gmail, you're dead, right? This happens all the time. So your email account is very important to secure. Very important. And the best way to do that is with two-factor authentication, which means not only would the bad guy need your password, and maybe that got leaked out or he figured it out, but he'd also need a special one-time code. It's generated every 30 seconds, so it's generated based on the time of day. That means the code's only good for 30 seconds, and that is really useful. Now, sometimes people will do this via text messaging. That's not super secure because it's very easy to spoof or hack smartphone SMS messages, unfortunately. There's lots of ways to do it. I won't go into the details, but it's not considered particularly secure. Even the National Institutes of Standards and Time says don't use SMS authentication. A lot of banks do. A lot of companies do. Even Google will if you ask for it. And the reason being, it's convenient. You don't have to install any app or do anything or buy a YubiKey. But there are more secure ways to do it. The next most secure way is with an authenticator app. And you've seen those, like Google Authenticator, which will generate that code. That's much more secure than text messaging. But even more secure than authenticator app is a dongle, a physical device that generates the code. Because the bad guy would actually have to physically access the dongle. So he would need your login, your password, and the dongle to get in your Gmail account. So Google encourages this. This is absolutely the most secure way. They gave physical keys to, what was it, 20,000 employees? Not one of them was phished or hacked in over a year. And that's why Google started offering these keys themselves. But for years, the king of the hill in this, and I still have the most respect for them, is YubiKey. They sell these keys fairly inexpensively. You put them on your keychain. I have a YubiKey. They have a variety of them. Some of them are just USB devices you put into your machine. You press a button and it generates the code as if it's typing. You have a more sophisticated one that also will, it'll do that, but it'll also do NFC. And that's because there's no USB port on your phone. They even have some that work with Bluetooth.
Yes.
Designed specifically for the iPhone, because the iPhone doesn't let you access the NFC chip. So the issue here is it's not seeing that NFC code in the proper way. I'm sure it's the same code that you would get if you plugged it into the phone via USB.
Right.
It's just that
I did follow the instructions, which one of the steps in the instructions said place the YubiKey key on the NFC area on the back of the phone. When you feel the vibration, then you can log in on your phone.
Oh.
But I got an error message.
Interesting. Yeah, cuz I know on the iPhone you can't just use the YubiKey. You actually have to, Google makes a separate application for this, which is really annoying. You have to run this application. And I wonder on an Android phone if it's the same thing, that maybe you need a separate Google authentication application that knows enough to look at the NFC, get the code that the NFC sent, and then apply it to the login. You know what I'm saying? But you're saying that they say you don't need anything special on the phone.
Yeah, you're talking about like a QR code to scan the...
Well, Google on the iPhone, Google actually makes a special authentication app for this purpose. I don't know what they do on Android. It could well be that the browser is just knows enough to... Because you're doing this in a browser, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that the browser knows enough. Okay, I'm waiting for this two-factor. It's probably going to come in through the NFC port. Let me wait and see what I get there. It may be that's sufficient. In which case, it wouldn't need a standalone app. That would make sense. You know why it does it on Apple, because Apple doesn't let apps talk to one another.
Right.
So, I don't, you know, I'm not familiar with this issue. Which Android phone
is it?
Yeah,
I'll have to, Note 9.
Okay. So, very nice phone, by the way. So, it is buzzing. You feel the vibration, which means it saw the code.
Right.
I don't know what's gone wrong here. Unfortunately, you should have tried this before you left.
everything is normal in terms of my accessing my Gmail account. This second key is a backup because I left the original key at home while I'm traveling.
Right.
I'm always afraid that I might lose it.
Smart.
So
no, and that's one of the nice things. If you have a physical dongle, and one of the nice things about the YubiKey is most companies will allow you to authenticate more than one YubiKey so that if you lose one or you want to leave one in a safe and travel with another one, you have that backup.
I do use the Google Authenticator as a backup.
And it will let you fall back. That's right. Work. It will let you fall back to that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're not locked out.
I also use the key because some of the computers I access won't allow me to put the YubiKey in the port.
Right. They lock off the USB port. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Yeah, so I've never used the NFC. You know, I briefly did the Google Super Authentication setup that required the two keys and all of that. But I always use Bluetooth, not NFC. So I don't know. I've never tried using the and have you? But you'd never tried it before.
No, because I knew I was going to be traveling with the phone.
Right.
I didn't bring a computer because I didn't need the computer for anything.
Right. Well, at least they do this, and you know, they let you fall back to the authenticator, and that is working for you, right?
Yeah. Everything is fine as far as that concerned. Also, I noticed that Amazon also allows you to generate a authenticator series of numbers in Google Authenticator also.
Yes, I use two-factor everywhere. Amazon, Fastmail, my email provider, uses YubiKeys, so I use it there. I used to use it with Facebook. Now I don't have an account, so I don't have to anymore. And of course, all banks, what you want to avoid is SMS, as you know. Does anybody, this is a good one. I haven't tried this, and I don't know. I do have an RFID YubiKey, so what I might do is set that up and try it and play with it.
I'll also be taking a look at the chat room and also the notes. Yeah. When I get back to New York, I'm actually going to be going on another trip. I'm going to Greece.
We're going to Greece in October. I can't wait. Where are you going?
I'm just doing a quick trip to, I think, Delphi.
Oh, fun.
Athens.
Fun.
Delphi and Athens, primarily.
fun. Yeah, we decided to spend a few extra days in Athens at the beginning of the cruise. And then we're going down the Suez, through the Suez Canal and down the Red Sea. I can't wait. It's going to be such a trip. Going to the...
Definitely. I'm looking forward to... eating all of the cheeses,
the best food
inside, and the best olive oil.
Oh, you bet. Don't drink the wine, all though. Right. Not so good, Laverne.
Yeah, I got that. Thanks again, Leo.
Yeah, good question. And, Let me keep looking.
Okay, and thanks in advance to the chat room.
Yeah, thanks, Laverne. See ya.
All right.
Take
care.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. That's an interesting issue. How did this happen? Last bit of the show for this weekend. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Let me take as many calls as I can so we can solve your problem, starting with George in Santa Monica. Hello, George.
Good afternoon, Leo.
Good afternoon, sir. How are you?
I'm fine. Well, I'm standing here near the rain.
Uh-oh.
But anyway, my problem is I have a Roku. And I usually watch your show on Twit Live on my Roku streaming.
Yes.
And lately, your show comes on, I'll watch it, and about 10 minutes into the show, it'll automatically just switch over to, like, triangulation or...
Are you watching on the YouTube channel?
YouTube channel.
Yeah.
It never used to do it.
I know.
Before.
You know, I don't know what's going on. So we used to have, he's talking about our podcast network, Twit, This Week in Tech.
Yes.
And we do a dozen or so shows about technology. This show's on the network as well as everything else. And we stream audio and video. And we used to have a Roku app, but then Roku changed their API. And the guy wrote the original app, Craig, who's a great guy, got a real job and was not allowed to do the new app for us. So we decided my cheap side came out, And I said, well, we don't need to make a new app. It was the only app we'd ever made. We don't need to make a new app because there's YouTube Live. We're on that. There's Twitch. We're on that. There's Mixer. We're on that. We're on so many different streaming platforms that people could use those apps on Roku. But lately, you're not the only one who's reported this. Not everybody reports it, but a number of people have reported this on YouTube, that it restarts the stream or it switches to another thing after watching for 15 minutes.
Yes.
But it's not everyone. So is it an autoplay issue? Maybe turn autoplay off? I don't know.
I don't know, but it used to work fine. It used to go all the whole show. But
Yeah. No, something changed. And so I'm not sure. And I don't know if it's us or if it's YouTube that's changed something. I'm just not sure. Now, my suggestion would be there are other apps like the Mixer app from Microsoft or the Twitch app from Amazon that you could watch us on. We're on both of those. And in both cases, it's mixer.com/twit or, twitch.tv/twit, which is confusing. Yeah. It's going to be there somewhere. Some other people are saying it doesn't happen on other YouTube Live channels. We're a YouTube Live channel. Does it happen to you with other YouTube Live channels?
Other shows too.
The same thing, not just our shows, but other people's.
Like Triangulation, it'll go for 10 minutes and it'll switch to.
Yeah, some people are saying in the chat room it doesn't happen on other YouTube Live streams, only ours. So if that's the case, it would be the way we've configured our streams.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna check with Patrick and see if there's anything we've done that's different.
What I do, I just turn it off and restart YouTube again and select your show.
Yeah,
and
but we don't want to make you do that each time.
I know.
Yeah. So try the Twitch. There's a Twitch app for Roku. There's a Mixer app for Roku. We're on both of those. Those should not happen. And I will on our side try to figure out. Patrick says we haven't changed the settings. We use a big box from Amazon called an Elemental to stream to YouTube Live, and we haven't changed those settings. Patrick's telling me in a long time, so I don't know why. But I think this is something going on. It's an interaction with YouTube. You might check and see if you've got on your YouTube app on Roku autoplay turned on. You might turn that off.
Okay.
And then we'll try to solve this one. Because you're not the first person to complain about it. I apologize.
You said go to Twitch?
Yeah, that's another app. If you go into your Roku store, you'll find a Twitch app, T-W-I-T-C-H. Okay. It's not ours. Okay. Twitch is a live, it's mostly game streaming from Amazon, but it also streams us, as does the Mixer app. Yeah, so try that.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Stay dry.
I will. You too. Yeah. Yeah. Go Rams, right?
Right.
I think nobody in L.A. really thinks of the Rams as an L.A. team yet. It's going to take maybe a couple more years. And I know in St. Louis, there was a great article in today's New York Times about the four cities that will not be watching the Super Bowl this year. St. Louis, number one for many years, 15 or 16 years, home to the Rams. They're not happy. Atlanta apparently not too happy after the Patriots whooped the Falcons a couple of years back. Of course, New Orleans not too happy. They're not going to be watching. I'll be watching, but I'll be watching for the commercials. You know, I like the commercials. Greg in Whittier, California. Our last call of the day. Hello, Greg.
Leo, how you doing, bud?
I'm great. How are you?
Good, good, good. Quick question: my Tesla. I just got a Model X, and I love it.
Yes, me too.
I want to see if you can help me, because I know you have a Tesla.
I have a Model X,
Setting the audio settings, because I listen to music, all genres, from talk show to country, rap to, and my tone, my balance, and those options, like, you're very confused. What's the midline for all music? Is there any such thing?
There really isn't, and it's mostly personal taste. If you... As most people would say, well, when they mixed this in the studio, they mixed it to be perfect. I'm going to just listen to it, what we call flat. And on the Tesla and most equalizers, flat is not at the bottom. Flat is in the middle. So you'll see an equalizer, it'll have a number of bands. when you move the slider up on the band, it means enhance those frequencies. So if you move the leftmost slider up, the low end is going to go louder. If you move it down, it's going to go quieter. And the baseline for all of those is not down, but the middle. That means it's as mixed. Now, of course, when they mix music in a studio, they're listening in a particular environment. Most recording studios have cheap speakers as well, so they can try it and see what it's going to sound like on a cheap AM radio or whatever. You know, I don't know what they're looking for. And often they'll mix it lately. This is, a lot of people have been complaining about this. Pop music is mixed highly compressed so that it punches out at you. But there's very little dynamic range. The quiet parts aren't very different than the loudest parts. They call that compression. And a lot of pop music these days is over-compressed. But that's nothing you can do anything about. You can't uncompress it. You can't. I guess you could expand it a little bit, but you're really kind of stuck with the mix. The problem is you may say, well, okay, when I listen at home and I'm listening on the equalizer with the equalizer settings flat, right in the middle, it sounds great, but I get in the car, it doesn't sound as good because the characteristics of the car are different. There's road noise, the chamber, the sound chamber is different. So maybe the equalization that you prefer at home is not the equalization you'd prefer in the car. And in fact, it's kind of interesting that they put an equalizer in that car because I guess that's the theory, right? And you should also remember there are a lot of people prefer more bass. A very common thing to do with an equalizer is something they call the loudness curve. You may remember in your old days on your stereo, you might have had a switch that said loudness. Well, what the loudness did would bump the bass a little bit at around, I think, 100, maybe 1,000 hertz at the lowish end, and bump the treble a little bit and leave the mid-range as it is. So it would look like kind of a two-humped camel, your equalizer curve. That's a loudness curve. And the theory there was when you're listening to music at a lower level, your ear isn't as acute at those low and high frequencies. It can hear mid-ranges fine. So boost the low and high end a little bit, and the music will sound better. But ultimately, you know, it's a matter of personal taste. What do you like? So play with it. Play with it. They also have, as many cars do, the ability to move the music around inside the car because they have multiple speakers. You can have it, you know, centered on the front seat on the driver. If you're the only one in the car, I would move it over there. You can have it centered in the middle so that everybody hears it equally. You can put it in the back. They even have Dolby processing. Most, you know, high-end stereo systems in cars these days have a lot of those features. Play with it till you like it. There's no perfect solution. Flat is going to be most, in theory, most like it was intended by the mixers. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy.
Have a great geek week.
Well, that's it for the Tech Guy show for today. Thank you so much for being here. And don't forget, TWIT, T-W-I-T. It stands for This Week in Tech, and you'll find it at twit.tv, including the podcasts for this show. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on Mac Break Weekly, iPads, iPhones, Apple Watches on iOS Today, security on Security Now. I mean, I can go on and on and on. And, of course, the big show every Sunday afternoon, This Week in Tech. You'll find it all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next week with another great Tech Guys show. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next time.